And we're back.
And I feel like you've got tube amps on the brain now.
I do. It sounds heavy, doesn't it? Just like there's weight. It's that, isn't it? Yeah. It's really hard to put into, like, is it even that though? Am I just listening to it on my computer screen? Is it anything to do with the amp? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think it is. I mean, Scott and I just came off of doing an episode, our last episode, about does the amp matter, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about all the tubes and then Scott sending me links last night, like post-pod episode, Scott sending me links of you know, fancy tube amps. I'm like, oh boy, here we go. It makes me want to bust all mine back out again. I'm like, oh, I'll probably never use these again. Yeah, I mean, when I hear amps recorded, it definitely is a different vibe to a DI.
Yeah.
I mean, is it because there's weight? Is it because you're actually hearing the air move into the microphone? I don't know. I think what it is for me is like the top end is different. The top end sounds more pleasant and not as like, you know, the top end of a bass through a DI can sound kind of sterile or clicky or almost too clean. And an amp just does something to the top that I really like, but maybe it is an air thing. I'm not sure.
It sounds great. If anybody's wondering, did you mention what amp we were talking about? The Matchless.
It's a Matchless Thunderman, right?
Matchless Thunderman. Thunderman. Oh, it's Thunderman. Who is Thunderman. It? Like, who's doing that? I'm going to look it up now on the YouTubes. Matchless Thunderman bass amp. It is. Who is it? It's it's Daniel James. And he's playing
it. That's right.
Yeah, the channel is 440 Sound. The dude is called Daniel James. And he, what a great player. I love his vibe.
Yeah, he sounds awesome.
He sounds great. He's just got sort of like, he's got a great feel the way he plays. I just love it. Like, he plays with a pick, but it's so good.
Oh, no, but he plays with a pick and... That's awesome.
Yeah, and absolutely. And he wears a pink hat. Any man that wears a pink hat.
Yeah, the pink hat's great.
Yeah, I dig that. I dig it. It's really great. So yeah, definitely check it out if you want to check out the Thunderman bass amp. But we were just talking about my shirt, weren't we? And for anybody that's watching on the video, woo!
You got those bright colors popping today. And it's funny because, you know, Scott sent a loom out to the team, you know, in that shirt and was like, really, what I wanted to do is just show you this shirt. And you mentioned something about like how you saw it and thought, oh, there's no way I could ever wear this shirt. And then you had to like call bullshit on yourself and say, wait, why do I think that about myself? I'm going to buy this shirt. I like the shirt. I'm going to wear the shirt. And it's funny because he popped on here. I was hoping you'd wear it. And he popped on here. And I see you in that shirt. And I just think what it makes me do, because you're wearing it, is I'm like, I should wear something more bright. Like, it gives me permission.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think at all. Like, I don't think people typically walk around and look at other people and think, oh, they shouldn't be wearing that. And if people do think that, it's on them. It tells you more about their insecurities than it does about the person wearing the shirt.
Yeah.
So wear that shirt, Scott. Wear it. Wear it a lot.
Dude, I dig it. Just to sort of like lean into what Ian was just saying there. I saw it online. I was like shopping for pants. Did you know that combats are back in, dude? Look. The 90s are coming back around. Holy shit. Yeah.
Dude, here's another. Let's just break it down. Let's break it down. Because combats, I've never heard that word before other than associated with a skirmish or war. And you're using it for pants. And trousers.
Now, what do you call these?
There's so much to get into.
What do you call these?
Okay, for right now,
what are these?
Because of the connection, right now, I can't see you.
Oh,
I can hear you, but I can't see you. But I imagine that you're lifting your leg into the shot to get a look.
Stood on
but a I still
chair.
Can't see you.
Oh, no. Can you see me yet?
I feel like I can't see you yet because the internet, but I feel like I saw them in the loom that you sent previously. And oh, I got your back. Stand up, get back up on that
chair.
I was on him.
Oh, what are these called? What are these called?
Hell
in the
States? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. We would call those, I think, do they have pockets? They have pockets on the side, right?
Yeah.
I think we call those cargo pants.
Oh, they're called combats. Cargo. Combats in
combats
the UK.
Combats is way cooler.
That's where it's at, dude. Well, in the 90s, it was all combats and cargo pants. And then it was like, what happened? Like, what are you doing with these baggy pants? You've got to have them tight the better. I mean, like, what the hell? Like, it's not sort of like crushing your balls. It's not tight enough. So, like, I saw these online. I was like, what? Combats are back in. I'm all in.
Oh, I love
it. Yeah, so I got these.
Oh, dude, it's great. It's great. Oh,
the 90s, man. It was great. Combats, man.
Yeah, it was. Dude, yeah. I went to college and I grew up in Montana and we were always in Montana. It was always late to fashion trends. I mean, sometimes desperately late, 5 to 10 years. And so I was wearing Levi's 501s, just like a standard fit jean. Yeah. And I'll never forget going to college in the Midwest in St. Paul, right across the river from Minneapolis. All of the kids there were wearing giant pants. I mean, like, I don't know if you remember JNCOs, if you guys had JNCOs, or if you had like Levi's pipes, those with the huge leg openings.
Massive.
Like sometimes, yes. And sometimes each leg opening was 36 inches. So, you know, like if you wore I always wore a 34 inch waist, 34 or 36. And then, you know, and then each leg was as big as the waist opening.
Yeah.
But I didn't wear them. And I got teased mercilessly, dude. People were like, oh, your pants are so tight. I can't believe you're wearing those tight pants. And they weren't. I mean, this was pre-skinny jeans, dude.
Pre-skinny jeans, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was pre, you know. I was just wearing, like, the classic, you know, like, 501. And I remember being like, oh, all right, I gotta. And so I bought some of those giant pants, dude. I mean, I went in, you know. And, oh, I wore that stuff for a while. Oh, but I might have to get a pair of combats now, too.
Jeez, dude, get some Louise. Combats, man. It's coming back around.
Yeah,
it's,
dude.
It's full circle, isn't it? And I actually remember, excuse my language, but I can remember when skinny jeans were in the first time round. Like the first time it was stonewashed. Yeah. Skinny jeans, like they were white and speckledy, and I can remember sort of like everybody, like thankfully this time around, it wasn't sort of like, it hasn't been like the late 80s and early 90s, it's been a little more, I guess, sort of like kind to us, but still, you know, like the combat cargos are coming back around and I'm all in, I'm loving it, but this is like, I've got nothing to say about the shirt. Obviously, I was shopping for the pants, I saw this shirt, and I instantly thought, I was like, oh, I could never wear a shirt like that. I'd be so self-conscious. And immediately after that thought, I was like, oh, you complete twat. I just called bullshit on myself. I was like, now I'm going to have to get the shirt and I would simply wear it until I don't feel self-conscious anymore. I went down to the supermarket earlier. People were just sort of like getting out the way. It was like people were like running for their sunglasses. They were like diving.
No, they weren't.
Yeah, I put it on it. Like Lisa was like, Lisa was like, what is that? I was like, yeah. I was like, it's cool, right? I was like doing the sales job. She was
I know, man.
I'm not sure about that shirt. And I was like, well, this is it. Until I feel comfortable, I'm going to have to wear this shirt. So you better make me feel comfortable in it. Otherwise, it's sticking around.
Spouses need to learn how to do the opposite. They need how to learn to say, oh, great. Or just not pay it, or actually not make any comment. That would actually be the thing, to just not mention it. And you'd be like, well, what do you see my shirt? She's like, oh, haven't you had that shirt for a while? Dude, that would be the ultimate move.
In anything, they need to learn how to do that in anything. So have you noticed, right? Does Emily, like, if you're sort of like around Emily and you, and she's ever sort of like, I'm not like calling out Emily, but like, I'm sure some days she's like a bit grumpy. You know, we all have them grumpy days. And for whatever reason, your mood starts to go the opposite way, and like, and you become super happy.
And you try to overcompensate. Yes.
You're overcompensating for that grumpiness. That happens all the time with me. I'm sort of like, oh, Taddy, you know. And even with
you become
even
the with, jester.
Oh yeah, yeah. And like, even with sort of like ideas, like Lisa's quite conservative in terms of her ideas. It's bad because it makes me come up with like ridiculous, well, not ridiculous, but sort of outlandish statements from like I was talking to you yesterday. I was like, Lisa, should we move to LA? And she was like, out of nowhere. She was like, why? I was like, why not? So her conservativeness kind of like makes me just lean the opposite direction, I guess, you know.
Oh, that happens with us all the time, for sure. And I even see it the other way too. Like sometimes I'll be, because I think, I don't know if Emily would say this, but I think I'm maybe more of the like cheery one in general. And that's not always, it's not always like real cheer. Sometimes it's passive aggressive cheer. Like what you're deciding, you know, there's someone who's grumpy and I'm like, hey, oh, things aren't so bad. Why are you so grumpy? I mean, that is the worst. Dude, that is the worst. If you're feeling grumpy and someone is like, oh, cheer up, smile. Oh, Lord. But yeah, I mean, sometimes she'll do that to me. Like, I'll be grumpy and I'm typically maybe not the like the grumpy one, and she'll be like, oh, why, you know, oh, things are great, and I'm like, oh, it really chaps me, man, it really. And then I go, oh, I think I do that to her. Oh, it's terrible.
I could never imagine you being
man,
grumpy.
I was, oh dude, I get grumpy. Your boy can get grumpy.
Really? What do you get grumpy about?
What do I get grumpy about? God. What do I get grumpy about? I think if maybe things don't go according to plan, maybe the kids, I get grumpy about the way things are said too. I'm really actually probably too sensitive to tone. If someone says something to me and their words don't match the sound of their voice or what they're saying, I'm really sensitive to that. So I'm like, oh, what do you... Hold on. It doesn't seem like your tone is matching what you're saying here. You know, I don't really love sarcasm. I know that it's clever and that it's a sign of a smart person, but when someone is really sarcastic to me, I want to go in. That actually makes me really grumpy.
That's interesting.
Like deep sarcasm. Yeah. I'm like, no, I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't know.
When you got to the UK, did you find, because I think that like the English are quite sarcastic sometimes, but maybe in a different way. Maybe in a different way, actually.
I think I grew up watching Monty Python and Fawlty Towers, and I love the dry British humor. And I do think there's a sarcasm, but there's a dry, it's a wit. At least I'm charmed by it. I mean, now maybe if I lived there or maybe if I was around it all the time, I wouldn't be. But I think the Brits get a pass on the sarcasm.
I think there's different variants of sarcasm, isn't there? I can remember hanging out with Bobby Vega and, what's that great bass player called? Black hair, young dude, black hair, kind of metal guy.
Young dude, like, black hair, metal guy.
Just tapping and stuff. Used to be very prominent on the scene and is kind of sort of like taking a back step. I think that he had a kid or something, so maybe he's doing the old dad thing. And, what was his name? Nate. Was it? Not Nate Navarro. Anyway, all that to say, I was in a room with these two guys, like Bobby Vega and this other individual who's great guy, great player, great teacher as well. And man, they were just sort of going at it, like being like super sarcastic with each. It was like almost like a boxing match. It was like it was quite funny to listen to. But it was, I think that it was where they came. I think they possibly came from the same area of the States, they had this whole thing going on. And I was like, I've never even. It was so, I guess, customized to the particular area that and it was almost, I couldn't almost follow it. I was like, this is so weird. It's like this, they're speaking English, but I couldn't really keep up with the humor side of it. It was quite interesting.
So interesting. I wonder who that is. I wish I could just say the name. I mean, and sometimes I think when sarcasm is a bit, it's I think it's actually quite awesome. Like when it feels kind of like it's playful, but there's a time, I think in like maybe my more meaningful relationships, like if it's somebody on a bandstand and we're just goofing around and kind of teasing each other, it's all good, dude. But if it's like my mom or my wife or my, I mean, my blood pressure goes up, dude. So yeah, I think that's what, I think that makes me grumpy. I don't know. Yeah, I try not to be too grumpy. Being a dad can make me grumpy too, man. I mean, you know, like, oh, just trying to deal with just being a parent. Sometimes, yeah. You know, the struggles of can get quite grumpy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, yeah. You know,
I resonate with that.
Par for the course.
Yeah, sometimes kids can be a bit crazy, can't they? Sometimes.
Yeah.
The story this morning was like just talking in, I wasn't grumpy about it, but sometimes he talks incessantly, like just nonstop. And I can walk out of the room and he'll be talking. I'll say, I'm just going to get so-and-so, and I'll walk out the to give him a heads up that I'm going, right? Dude, I'm just going to get something out of the bedroom. I'll walk out and I can hear him still talking, and it'll fade as I walk down the corridor, and then I come back. He's still talking. He's talking to me. I'm not there. He knows I'm not there. But yeah, right. He's still talking. It's hilarious. It cracks me up.
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
man.
Like sometimes you want to say to your 8-year-old, like, are there any, you could ask about me sometime. And then you realize, oh, that's ludicrous. This is an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about anything more than yourself?
Oh, dude, I've had like, a couple of friends. No. I've had a couple of friends, and they're like, what's it like having a young kid when our kids were like really small? And what's it like having kids because they're about to have one? I was like, this is what it's like. I was like, you could walk out your door, right? You could get driven over by a truck, and then accidentally somebody sets you on fire as you're crawling back in your house, and the kids are there as you crawl back in. I was like, they don't give two shits, man. They're just like, have you seen this toy? And you're like, I'm dying on the floor. But have you seen this toy? And then they'll start crying because you haven't got the toy. I was like, that's what it's like. And that's hilarious. It's so funny. It cracks me up. Yeah, they're so.
I mean, in a way, right? That's the only time you get to be like that, right? Exactly. As a kid, it's the only time you get to focus on, like, really focus on you, is when you're a child, and so maybe that's just the time that, hey,
oh yeah,
you know, I love it. That's the right time.
I love it because they're just so consumed with like everything that's going on around them. It's like they're in their own little world. And I think there's something beautiful about that. Yeah, they're super in the moment. Yeah. And all they can see is what they can see, right? It's or actually what they want to see, you know. It's fascinating, man. I get grumpy sometimes. As I asked you, I was like, do I get grumpy sometimes? I do get grumpy sometimes. I think that,
Yeah, I want to know what makes you grumpy, Scott.
I do get grumpy sometimes. Do you know what I get grumpy at? I get grumpy when Lisa gets grumpy at me. That's what sets me off. I'm pretty stable, but when Lisa gets grumpy at me and I think it's uncalled for, I get super. Yeah, I'm not like the guy that's sort of like, oh, you know, she needs a little bit some more support from me. Don't know, and I'm like, it grinds on me a bit. A lot. I'm she's like, you're supposed to be supportive. I was like, I am being supportive. But yeah, that's generally marriage. What makes me grumpy. Story yesterday, my little boy who's just turned 9, he said it was like dinner time, which is dinner time in the UK, or at least in the northern of the UK. That's like lunchtime, right? So it was lunchtime, and Story said, you know, you guys have been arguing all morning. And I went, I know. And I looked at Lisa and I was like, and that is because you're a big stink bag, Lisa. And Lisa was like, great parenting, Scott. And then we both just cracked up, and then it was fine after that. But it just took one of our kids to be like, you guys have been arguing all morning. And just to sort of give people context, when Lisa and I argue, we don't shout at each other or anything like that. It's not like we're not like that couple who sort of like, and then she's like, don't do that. So it basically, it's a conversation where we're disagreeing. Like a consistent, that's what it is. It's a conversation where we're consistently disagreeing, and there's a little bit of like an undertone to it. So,
yeah.
So if anybody's thinking, you shouldn't argue in front of your kids, I would actually say right back at you, I would say, actually, I think it's really important to do that in front of your kids, because they're going to be in situations when they're older, when they don't agree. And if they've been around parents that scream at each other, they will probably scream at their spouse or their friends and stuff like that.
For sure.
And that'll get followed on. So what we're really cognizant of and mindful of is if we're disagreeing, and it's, you know, obviously there's, you know, it depends on the context, but in just general day to day, if we're grumbling with each other, we don't go away and hide from the kids and then scream and shout at each other behind closed doors.
Oh, sure. Of course the kids can hear.
Like,
it's scary. Oh,
yeah, that's bad. So we do it sort of like in front of the kids, and then we generally talk about it afterwards, so they get a bit of context for it, and to say, this is how, you know, we disagreed on something and this is how we work through it. And look, we love each other. We're still friends now. Like, and the kids are like, oh, okay. Because Lisa, she didn't come from that. Like, she, when we got together, we had an argument and she was like, oh, are we breaking up now? And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, well, she came from that background where there was obviously sort of like a lot of breakups and stuff like that on her parents' side. So she carried that with her. So we've been really mindful of sort of like, how do we actually, do we put ourselves in a place where we're sort of like a great example for the kids, and they can learn sublimity from us without us? Cause I'm like about sort of like, you know, monkey see, monkey do. You can tell the kids stuff, but if you're not showing them at the same time, it doesn't matter.
You're
They will just model what their parents do.
That sounds so healthy. And I totally agree with you that, like, fighting or, you know, having an argument, a disagreement in front of the kids and then talking about it later is so healthy. Emily and I have struggled our entire relationship with arguments. Sometimes there's been shouting. I mean, we've gone to counseling for it. I mean, we can ratchet up the intensity with each other. But the thing that we always, so we have had disagreements. We have even shouted and the kids are there and it's awful and we know it's awful. Thing that we always try to do is then apologize to one another in front of them. And I will say, dude, it's so hard, or it can be so hard to do that.
Well,
like,
dude,
especially if you feel like,
you know, like, we shout like you were right. Yeah, we've lost it sometimes. We've lost it. Like, it doesn't happen like all the time, but maybe sort of like, I don't know, like once every 2 months or something, like we'll shout, you know, and it's really hard.
Sure.
But it's been a trip going on that. It's been a real journey for both of us. I guess more on Lisa's side. I hope she wouldn't mind me saying this, but it was very hard for her to have like a really heated disagreement where we're like, it's heated. Yeah. And then just like, you know, come back down to earth and be like, actually, okay, it's all said and done. You know, we love each other. Let's sort of like, it's hard. She sort of like holds it.
She holds it. Yes.
Yeah. And then she'll mull over it in the day. So she's been trying to sort of like get out of that. So it's been,
I'm the same. Honestly, I'm very similar to Lisa in that way, where like, if there's something that happens and I don't feel like maybe I was heard or I couldn't get my point across, I want to talk. I want to keep talking about it. And my wife was like, we're going around in circles. Like, we've talked about this. It's done. And I'm like, no, but I don't think you understand. You know, like, I've had real struggles with that too. But I think, like, for our kids, the best thing that we have ever done is talk about it in front of them. Or if it got scary, or if one of them cried because we were talking too loud or yelling, to talk about it to them, apologize and say, hey, this is how we're working it out, like you said. And something else that I did recently that took so much, it's so hard for me to do, and I don't know why it's so hard for me to do, is when I feel like I've been too grumpy or too intense with the kids, is to actually just apologize to them and say,
Lisa's great at that, dude.
Is she? Yes.
Oh, she's
and it's
great.
So powerful, dude. It's so powerful. And I think that, like, when you do that, it doesn't then enable the kid to be, oh, well, now I can get away with more shit. It's not about that. It's like they then feel safer. They feel like, oh, wow. Like, I remember there are a couple times when my mom in my childhood would apologize to me. And I remember being sort of caught off guard by it. And it just made everything like the anger went down, the grief and the holding on to things went down. Yeah. And so I, man, my And shout out to my wife too, Emily. We had a real stonker, as you would say, the other day, where you know there was a terrible fight, and she came back up the stairs and said, "I need to apologize to everybody. I'm so sorry for this." Looked at the kids in the eye, looked at me in the eye, and then I'm like, "Oh, I guess I got to do this too." And I was like, "You guys, I'm also sorry for my part in this because I shouted as well, you know." And I mean, dude, then it was just like, whew, I mean, it feels so good. And it's, I think maybe it's control or that thing of wanting to be right, why we don't apologize. Or maybe that is what it is for me, why I feel like, no, I don't want to apologize because I don't want to admit or something. Mm. But it's not about that. It's about saying my reaction to this, right or wrong, like my feeling of right or wrong doesn't matter because I went over the top and had a reaction that made you scared or made you cry, and I'm sorry for that. And boy, that's a powerful apology, is a powerful tool, you know.
Oh yeah, it's wild learning about this stuff and trying to get that skill set together, isn't it? Because like for me, like I can remember having nothing. This was like no skill set. I can remember when Story was born, and then we'd have these much more heated, you know, we'd argue and stuff like that. And I can remember being really, really just like, oh shit, we can't do this anymore. Like that, I can remember just having that thought like, oh, we need to sort that out.
Right.
Obviously, to my point earlier, obviously we disagree. We shout sometimes, you know, that for sure. But like nowhere near like what it was before we had kids, you know, because before you've got kids, it doesn't matter. You can be like, don't be so stupid. Like, you know, you're ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? Just shouting at each other. Just like, whatever, you loser.
It's so different. Yeah, because there's not a scared little child in the corner going, Mom and Dad, stop.
Yeah, you can just do whatever, can't you? It's wild, man. Yeah, it's been a journey kind of learning about that stuff. And yeah, I think...
Oh, I'm sure.
I think we're doing okay, dude. I think we're doing okay.
Well, that's amazing, man. I mean, and we've got this episode. I've been really excited for this because just talking about what you went through with your focal dystonia diagnosis and talking to... I was listening to a previous podcast before today where you talked briefly about that. And I said on the pod, man, we need to do a full episode about this. And something I said in the podcast that I wanted to mention again to you, and that I hope it didn't come across as insensitive, is that I constantly forget that you have this neurological condition that I know you're going to explain and talk about, but it's, you don't hang on to it like, or you don't talk about it or act as though it's this big hindrance in your life. And so, and then, you know, you wear a glove, and I know you'll talk about that today too. Yeah. And I have started to see the glove as just a part of you. And when I see the glove, I sometimes forget that it's related to this neurological condition.
And, oh, that's interesting.
And I'm sorry for that.
Sometimes,
you know, you're like, dystonia. And I'm like, oh my God, that's right. But it's why, I mean, you know, because I just don't, I don't see you as using it as an excuse or using it as a crutch. But then I need to remember, oh yeah, like when I see all that Player's Path material that you did, I'm like, I need to remember, oh my God, I bet that was really intense for Scott because of dystonia.
Yeah.
I want to, but before I'm going to stop talking here in a minute, but I wanted to, I wanted to say I'm sorry to you for not being more aware and sensitive about that in your life, in my interactions with you. I just view you as this sick, badass bass player that wears a glove for no other reason than you do.
Dude.
And then I remember, Scott's dealing with something here. You know,
I never really think about it, honestly. I never really think about
right?
it. Yeah, I never really think about it. I think that I think about it when in terms of sort of like projects I'd love to do, and I'm like, that's a bit of a grind. Mm. That it's, and I'll get into why somebody has context and stuff like that. But that's the only real time that I think about it is when I'm wanting to go do something, and then I'm like, and there've been various projects in the past where it's been not. ideal. You know, it's been not ideal. Yeah, so, for instance, I can remember recording something with Josh Smith and Gary Novak down in London. And the night before, yeah, I was in a hotel room in London, and the night before, all of the symptoms just freaking flared up like crazy. I'm like, you complete dick. So, yeah, so it's really bad. So if you watch the video, I've got two gloves on because I had it in both my hands at the same time. So it was like, not only was I recording this thing with Josh Smith and Gary Novak, like Gary Novak, I mean, like, holy crap.
Yeah.
And so I was recording this trio thing with these two incredible musicians. I'd never played with them before. We didn't have any rehearsals. I had to get it right first time round in the studio because it was all being filmed. On top of that, I had sort of like, my hands were going like, it was just mayhem. My fingers were sticking together and all kinds of shit. So all that to say that I never think about it in general until it kind of kicks me in the ass sometimes.
There's something.
Which it inevitably does.
In that instance, do you feel like the stress, what was the trigger for the symptoms to reemerge so aggressively?
I was like learning the tunes. I've been learning the tunes that week quite, you know, spending sort of like a few hours a day practicing the tunes and just getting ready for it. So that's what, and that's the key thing with focal dystonia. And it's completely different with many different people. For me, it kind of, I can ride the line, but if I play too much, the symptoms flare up. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to have to take a few weeks off playing, maybe 2 to 4 weeks. You know, not completely off, but not really played that much at all. Maybe like not even, you know, not even 5 minutes a day, really. Just sort of like just get the heck off the base. But in that situation, I couldn't because I had a session the next day. So I can remember like lying in the bath in the hotel, trying to relax, going, come on, it's cool. I've got this. It's fine.
Oh, Scott.
It was like, it's a real thing. It's definitely a thing. So if anybody's wondering what it is, like what is this thing called focal dystonia? It is a neurological movement disease or disorder. I've seen it called both, where the frontal cortex of your brain remaps itself. So on the front of your brain, you've got this honeycomb type material, and each of the little honeycombs, a little electric signal goes down one of those honeycombs, and let's say it moves a finger. So each honeycomb has got a particular part of the body that it moves, particular muscle set that it moves. And with focal dystonia, the if you think about like inside a bee's inside of like a beehive, all of those little honeycombs, they're all separate, aren't they? What happens with focal dystonia is the honeycomb, it breaks down. So the electrical impulse will go down one honeycomb and it'll then shoot into another one because it's broken down. The edges break down slightly. So, and that causes havoc. So what happens is, or that you get your hand, your fingers sticking together, your fingers sort of like, your muscles cramping up, but it's not painful. It's all happening inside your mind. Your brain is doing this stuff and it can't control it. So you might go to play a passage on the piano or on a guitar or on a bass, and your muscles will go into spasm or your fingers will stick together. There's a lot of different symptoms, but it's a whole lot of, it's hard. And, you know, people have absolutely, you know, had to stop playing. Many people have had to stop playing and take, you know, complete break from their professional career or never go back again. And for me, I think it started in my late 20s. I think honestly, mid-20s is when it started, you know, raising its head up. And then, and this is really common actually, that when it first starts, and it's obviously, and for me, it's isolated in my hands, but some people get it in other parts of their body. When it first starts, it can be progressional. So with me and many other people, it won't kick in straight away. And the obvious thing to, and when you're playing, it might just feel like, it's like I can't play as well today. It's like, it's not connected as it should do. And obviously, you know, therefore you're like, need to practice more.
Right.
That is the wrong thing to do. Because what you're going to try and do is actually force through it. So things won't feel quite right. Not all the time, but sometimes you pick up your bass, it won't feel quite right. And what you'll do is you'll try and overcompensate for that and actually start practicing more. Because you're practicing more, the symptoms will get worse. And then you practice more, then the symptoms get worse. And then you practice, and then it's just, and it is a flywheel. And what happened with me is it just kept on carrying on. And it got to a point I was like, oh wow, this is something really weird's going on. So I went to the doctor, and it actually started out with my index finger, only my index finger of my right hand.
Of
my right hand,
See, I didn't even know. I didn't even know it was both hands.
It started off in my right hand, in my index finger. So I'd be playing, say like da 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 da.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it would like be like somebody just unplugged my index finger and it stopped moving on its own completely. So I'd be trying to go like da 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 da, and my index finger would just stop, and I'd be like, what? And shake my hand, and then I'd be able to start playing again. So all of that, you're like, is it carpal tunnel? Is it RSI?
Right, of course. Dude,
yeah, and you go to any normal doctor, and they're the same thing. Hey, it's probably RSI. It's probably carpal tunnel. Blah, 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 blah. You know, and it actually takes a long time normally to actually be diagnosed with focal dystonia because it's not, even though it's common, it's not that common. And doctors don't really know, you know, obviously when you get to a certain level, they know what it is. But general GPs will not have a clue. They're going to send you to the physiotherapist. The physiotherapist probably won't know what it is. You know, so you go round in these circles. Then, oh man, I can tell you, it took me about a year to 18 months to get diagnosed. Like physiotherapists, acupuncturists, like, is it coming from, it must be something to do with your back. So they're sending you to like,
Yes. And because they're all thinking musculature, tendon, right? Exactly. They're thinking about physical, physiological.
Nobody is thinking about the brain. Nobody's thinking about the brain. Right. So I can't remember.
So did you end up having to go then to a neurologist?
I did, yeah. I actually bypassed the whole sort of like national health system. And I was like, I'm just going to pay to go to a neurologist. And I can't remember why I had a, maybe I spoke to somebody or whatever, but I had some kind of, there was something that sparked me to be like, I'm actually going to go and see a neurologist. So I went to a neurologist, had an MRI, did all of that thing. And then it was him that was like, I think that you've got this thing called focal dystonia. And that day he was like, just, is there anything that you can do? And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, professionally, is there anything else you can do? I was like, no, because through all of this, I'm like, you know, I'm just going to find, somebody's going to fix me, right? And he was like, oh, you probably won't work as a professional musician anymore.
There's something, surgery.
Yeah. And he just said, yeah, you probably won't work as a professional musician anymore. And I was like, like mind blown.
Yeah.
Because all I'd done.
Crushing.
I was crap at school. All I did from like 12 or 13 was play guitar, then transition to bass. It's all I'd done for like years and years.
Right.
I didn't do anything else. And there was this sudden moment where he said, oh, you probably can't do that anymore. And I joked with you, didn't I, when I told you last time that nobody, my wife was on holiday in a foreign country and my parents were on holiday and my brother was living in Moscow at the time. I was like, seriously? Yes. I've just been like, my heart's been ripped out and stamped on. And I've got nobody to talk to about it. Oh, it was awful. So it was really hard. And then after that, I went on this, just because I'm a stubborn little shitbag, I was like, okay, I'm not going to take this. And then I started seeking out professionals. So I started speaking with a guy over in Spain, traveled out to Seville. He was a specialist in focal dystonia. There's actually two or three specialists out in Spain that deal with focal dystonia. It's very common on classical guitar, like flamenco. Obviously, it's big in Spain, so I think that's where the hookup is there. It's also worth mentioning that people can get this in their lips as well. So like horn players, if you're a trombone player or a trumpet player, you can get this in your lips. It is, or you can get it in your eyes. You can get it in your voice. Some people can't talk because they've got focal dystonia in their voice box. Like it is bad.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, dude, yeah. So anyway, by the way, as all of this was going on, I started playing with a plectrum and I was like, I can beat this shit. I'm just going to start playing with the plectrum. It freaking spread into my left hand, like within 2 months. Yeah. Wow. So I was like,
oh, it started only in your right hand.
Yeah.
And then it went, and then you tried to bypass it, and it went to your left hand.
And then I had it in both hands. Yeah, and that was all going on at the same time. So I'm seeking out these specialists, and I'm traveling out to Spain. I travel out to Seville. I traveled out to Barcelona to see a specialist there. They give me exercises. I also worked with somebody called Catherine Butler in London. I was just like trying to find somebody I could work with, right? And I was like, dude, it was brutal. At one point, I was sitting there doing, it's called like neural remapping, where you're trying to remap the neural pathways in your brain. And I was sitting for like 3 or 4 hours a day with a blindfold on, feeling dominoes with my fingers, trying to match dominoes for 3 or 4 hours a day. I was like psychologically not in the best place. It was like brutal. Because you're doing this stuff and you are desperate. Like I was desperate. I'm like, I have to make this work. So that domino thing was terrible. hey, if you've got focal dystonia listening, like try it out. It might work for you. Anyway, all that to say that when I was going to see Catherine Butler in London, she mentioned that one of her patients, a violin player who was also suffering from it, was wearing latex gloves. And if for whatever reason, it was like creating some kind of, it was tricking the brain. It was doing something sensory to the hand so that the symptoms didn't kick off and start again. And I was like, well, I was a huge fan of Etienne Mbappe, bass player. Yes. Where's the black gloves? I was like, Etienne can do it. Maybe I can do it. So I bought some latex gloves. That wasn't going to work. Then I bought some big baggy white silk gloves. That wasn't going to work. There's even a lesson with me online wearing this massive white clown glove. If you write Scott Devine, Richard Bonalick into YouTube, you will see me with this massive white.
I'm going to find it.
Yeah, this big white clown glove. So that didn't work. And then I found these, like, it was actually black silk gloves that similar to what Etienne was wearing. That definitely worked. And then somebody actually started creating these gloves, and he sells them on Amazon, called musicians gloves for guitar players or bass players and stuff like that if they're getting sore fingers. Anyway, shout out to that guy because he saved my life. I started buying them.
So cool.
And it did. I could bypass the symptoms by using the gloves, and I stopped searching for a cure. And that was a really important thing for me. Maybe I'll do it in the future. Sometimes I'll get people like emailing me, hey, do you want to work with me? I'm a specialist. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Honestly, it was so brutal going through that like maybe like a 2 or 3 year period where I was searching for this cure and flying around the world trying to meet with people. And it was so brutal psychologically that I was just like, fuck it. I don't need that. Well, once I'd found the gloves, I was like, I can make this work for me. And then, you know, in Scott's basis and started all in among that and stuff like that. So, and then here I am. And that was really the journey with it. At that point when I found the gloves, I never went back. It was so brutal.
So after you found the gloves, were you first wearing them on both hands?
Yes.
And did it make an immediate difference?
Yes. Yeah, it was That's pretty incredible. Immediate. Yeah, it was immediate. Yeah, it just feels different. It's really hard to put into words. It just felt different. Yeah. I felt like, because sometimes my muscles spasm, my fingers, like, I'd go to move, for instance, my middle finger on my left hand, my little finger would move, vice versa. I'd go to move my little finger, my middle finger would move, like, it was crazy. And then my two middle fingers, this middle finger, my ring finger would stick together. Like, and I put the glove on, and it just felt different. It was just sensory-wise, it was different. So when I played, but saying that, it's still there. It's absolutely still there. To my point earlier, it's like what the gloves do is that they take down the symptoms a lot, and also they reduce the symptoms a lot, and then they also give me the ability to play the bass, you know, every day for a little while, or if I've got a gig, I can go and do it. Or I mean, they give me they give me the ability to go do that. Whereas if I don't wear the gloves and I went and did a gig, it would be, I'll be in hot water. I'm sort of like, oh, great. Now I'm going to do this gig and now I'm not going to be able to play for the next 2 weeks.
And when you pick up a different instrument, like I know you've been playing uke a little bit lately. Do you find that on a different stringed instrument, like if you play guitar or even if you play a six string bass, or I mean, we could just keep it to uke. Do you find that you're feeling the same symptoms? Like when your hand touches a string, do you feel the symptoms or how is it different on a different instrument?
It's slightly different. It's slightly different. But the key thing is that if I'm a bit of a silly Burke, which I have been recently playing that ukulele and not taking care of my body, it will then it'll transition. So I'll be playing the uke and it'll feel okay. It's okay. And then after a few days, I'm like, I can feel it just in my fingers. I can just feel it in my fingers. And then I'll pick up the bass. I can feel it straight away. And that actually even now I'm getting better and better at it. Like at one point I actually used to wear the gloves all the time. I used to wear the gloves all the time.
To do everything.
Even when I wasn't playing. Because my hands would just feel strained, my fingers would stick together all the time and stuff like that. I can remember at one point I had two pencils with rubbers on the end, and that's how I used to type for over 2 years.
Wow!
Because if I typed with my fingers, the symptoms would get worse, and I still have to be careful now. I have to be really careful when I'm typing, not to overdo it.
That makes so much sense. That makes so much sense why you don't like to type big, long, you know, messages in Slack, or like why you like Loom.
Yeah, gotta be super careful. Yeah, gotta be
yes.
super careful.
See, I just, I mean, this is so, because it's not forefront on the things that you say. You know, it's just something that you're living with. I forget, and I'm sorry about that. I need to remember.
I'm really crap at communicating, actually, because when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I've not actually told anybody in the entire team why I send a lot of video messages instead of typing it out. It's so I've got to keep the typing to a minimum. Not a minimum, but I can't. Like if I typed all that stuff, I just wouldn't be able to play. And I'm the same with email as well. I'll send a lot of video messages instead of emailing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's huge. That's actually really, really helpful for me to know. You know, I think it would be helpful for everybody to know.
I sense
though in you a thing of like, you don't want to make it a big deal. You don't want, you know, like some really good things have come from it. And I want to ask you about that too. Like this whole new chapter emerged after that diagnosis. Right. And so I kind of sense in you that like, you're not going to talk about it. You're not going to use it as a crutch. You're not going to, you know, it's not a weakness, but then there are things, right, that we don't see that are a struggle for you. And I feel like you have the right and the, you absolutely have the right to talk about that stuff and to say, hey, here's what's going on. And it wouldn't make anyone think like, oh, Scott's, you know, using this as an excuse or something. Do you feel that?
I think that, yeah. But I think it comes from a different place. It's not, it comes from protecting my own thoughts rather than other people's. So it's not that I'm trying to sort of like play it down for the people. It's not like, you know, I want them to think I'm cool and like, I don't want to sort of like, it's not that I'm trying not to say, oh, I've got this thing and it affects me every day and sort of like, I guess, openly speak. It's not like I'm trying to play that down. I'm trying to play it down for me in my mind. I'm like, it's almost like, just push it to one side. Do not think about it. Do your thing. Don't let that get in the way. So it's more about protecting my own mind. And that's probably why I don't speak about it so much. And it's not always great because it's also about everything else. Like from a health standpoint. So for instance, right, I have not been to the doctor. I went to the doctor 2 weeks ago, and it's the first time I've been to the doctor in probably 10 years. And it is because me and Edwin and I were laughing about, he was like, whoa. He was like, you might want to go and just get a checkup. Shout out to Edwin on the team. Yeah. And the reason being is that, well, yeah, all that to say that, So I think it does come from a good place in terms of the focal dystonia and not like wanting to focus on it. Just, you know, focus on what you're doing, focus on what the, you know, the goal that you're focused on and all that good stuff. But then also there is a, you know, it's not, it's also to do with just the way I'm wired. Just that, like, I'm not very, I'll be limping and things will be falling off me. And like Lisa will be like, you know what? You might want to go to the doctor. Like, I've got like a lung thing going. I had to go to the doctor. So anyway, I went to the doctor 2 weeks ago and I said to him, I was sitting there and I was like, so I think I've got like a chest infection. And he's like, oh yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like a bit sore in the chest. Not wheezy, but I'm like coughing up some muck and stuff like that. And it's been going on a while. And he's like, oh, when did it start? And even some people on the podcast might have heard me coughing and stuff like that. You heard me coughing yesterday.
Yeah, sure.
The doctor's like, oh, when did it start? And I'm like, just before Christmas. And he's like, oh, so just before this Christmas. I'm like, no. I was like, just before last Christmas. And he was like, and there was this sort of like this pause. And he was, and he was like, just before this, like this Christmas? And I was like, and then I had to like reaffirm what I said. I was like, no, like,
no, I mean,
like a year and 2 months ago, maybe like a year and three months ago. Wow. And he was like, oh dude. Well, he didn't say that, but he was like, okay. So
you saw it in his eyes. You saw the, oh dude, in his eyes.
So I'd love to say it only comes from a place of me being sort of like, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to ignore everything. But I think it also comes from maybe like that, you know, that other side of me that will sort of like limp along with bits falling off me. All that, and I'll just add in as well that Lisa says this, and it's something that maybe, like, maybe she's got something. She said that after going through the whole focal dystonia thing, I went to see so many freaking doctors. And so, like, and I got passed around. It was like I was running the gauntlet, man. And it was for a good few years that it kind of just like turned me off the entire. Yes. I was like, I never want to see another doctor in my life. Yeah. So it was that because element that was as well.
I mean, when you're, dude, I just got goosebumps all over my arms. When you were talking about the domino thing, 3 to 4 hours blindfolded, trying to play with dominoes, the way you just described that was traumatic. I mean, I think that was a trauma. You talked about the desperation of trying to, I have to find a cure. I have to find a cure. You're going around. It's your whole life. You're traveling. You finally find something that isn't a cure, but it's going to let you move forward. And so I wonder if for you, feeling like going back to the doc is going to reignite some of those traumas.
Yeah, for right? sure.
Like,
yeah.
Don't make me fucking touch the dominoes again. Like,
almost
sure. like, yeah. I don't even want to know. You know, like when you have a cough, I feel that too in a way. Like, I don't like going to the doctor. And it's probably some deep-seated thing that I'm not very, like, I'm not connecting and aware of. But it's almost like I don't want to know. I just want to move on. like keep calm and carry on. And, you know, and sometimes that's good, but sometimes it's not to ignore.
Sometimes it's not.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Can we do something fun on the podcast?
Yeah, of course.
I am literally supposed to... I'm supposed to be meeting with Gary Willis in like 1 minute. I'm just gonna email him and say, dude, I'm gonna put dude, all caps, gonna be 15 minutes late. Is that
so
cool?
Sorry, Gary.
Sorry, Gary. Let's see what he comes back with. He'll be fine.
Oh, sorry Gary. Gary. well then in our if as long as Gary's cool, in the last bit that we have here, I think it's really important to talk about what you chose to do after the diagnosis and after you maybe moved on to this is something now, this is a new normal, this is something you're going to be dealing with, you're not going to cure it, you're not going to take a pill, you're not going to have a surgery. It's greatly impacting on, you know, you thinking about going and doing tours, gigs on the cruise ship, you know, West End gigs. What happens next? And I know that is connected to SBL. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I was in this, it's wild, man, thinking about this stuff. So I was in this really sort of like weird transition period. I'd been a pro musician, and then all of that was under threat. So, and I think the writing was on the wall that, oh, you can't play for a living anymore, which I actually don't do anymore, which is, you know. So the guy was kind of right. You know, the neurologist, even though I sort of, well, I didn't hate him when he said that, but I was just like,
it was just crushing.
It felt like it just kicked me in the balls, you know, and I didn't agree with him. I think that's maybe what I want to sort of communicate.
Sure, yes.
I was like, whatever, dude.
What do you know?
You haven't met me before. You haven't met me. You don't know me. I'm going to crush this. 3 years later, I'm like, The guy's like, I told you. But anyway, I was in this sort of like weird trance. So I was going through all of this sort of like flying and getting treatments and dominoes and all that shit. And that was all good. And then and then all of this stuff happened at once, really. So I found that I could play with the gloves. So that was one thing that found I could play with the gloves. Great. But I didn't think to myself, okay, I'm going to do SBL. It was like, I could play with the gloves. I can, maybe I can teach a bit. Maybe I can teach online and actually earn some money, because I can play for maybe, if you're teaching, because I didn't have any money, like no money, like it's panic stations. And so I was like, oh shit, maybe I can, if I could teach for an hour, if I could teach somebody an hour, maybe I have to play for like 10 or 15 minutes during the hour. I think that'll be fine. So I use the gloves, I'll be able to teach. So at that point, I'm like, how do I actually get some Skype lessons? How do I teach people? And somebody was like, oh, you can check out this thing called YouTube. And I ended up on YouTube at this local internet cafe, and I was there on the internet cafe watching Van Halen solos. And I was like, maybe I could upload lessons to this. I'll upload lessons to YouTube, this thing called YouTube. And then I'll get this thing called a website together, and people will be able to find me on the website, and I'll give them Skype lessons.
Yeah.
That was the master plan to get me out of the crap and so I could pay the rent. So I went out and I bought my first computer. I bought my computer, and then I bought a little camera, and I figured out how to use it, and I'm doing some lessons on the camera, and I'm uploading them onto YouTube, and I figured out how to build a website. That was brutal, because this was the first computer I'd ever owned in my life, other than a Commodore 64 when I was 11. So I was like figuring that out, and that was brutal. Anyway, so got that up and running, and Gary Willis says, no problem, dude.
We've got a buffer. Thanks, Gary.
Boom. Cheers, Gary. Yeah. And so all of that was going on. And then at the same time, I'm also like, but shit, I need to earn some money. So I was like, oh, I've just built a website. That was pretty cool. Maybe I can maybe I can walk people's dogs. I'm not kidding you, dude. So I was like,
amazing.
I was like, I'll put another website together. I'm going to be a dog walker. So I put a website together. It was like, I probably came up with a name or something. And like, you know,
Divine Dogs. I mean, it's not a bad name.
Dude, it's not a bad name. So I put a dog walking website together. I walk no dogs. But I did put the website together. So I put the website together. And then at the same time, I'm like, oh, the dog walking thing. Maybe I don't want to walk dogs. That seems like a race to the bottom, you know? Like, no offense to any dog walkers out there, but I live in the north of England. It rains 60 or 70% of the time here. I was like, do I really want to be like traipsing around in mud and shit and picking up dog poop and all that? So I was like, right, okay, maybe the dog walking thing isn't the thing. And then I was like, oh, maybe I'll go back to guitar making, because I really loved the idea of, well, I didn't love the idea, but I worked from like when I was like 17 till when I was like about sort of like 19 or 20. I was an apprentice luthier at Overwater Basses, which is why I started playing bass. So I thought, maybe I can start making guitars or something. Maybe I can. And then I was like, you know, as I said to you, I was like, I like the idea of making acoustic guitars. And there's a classical guitar making school that's like an hour and a half away. So I contacted them, and I was going to go in and run. And all of this went on at the same time. And I was actually going to go down for my interview at the Classical Guitar Making School, which is called the Newark School of Guitar Making. I was going to go, and that morning, everything had just started getting a little bit of traction on YouTube. It just started, I mean, like, tiny, dude. I'm like, maybe I had like 5,000 subscribers, maybe not even that, maybe less, maybe like 2,000 or 3,000. And I put my rucksack on to go to this interview at the guitar making school. And and having this moment in the kitchen thinking, it should, because I knew if I went, I was going to go and do it. Because I'd probably, yeah. I'd meet people there and I'd like them. I'd be like, oh, this is really great. I'd fall in love with the idea. And I come out, I walked upstairs and Lisa was still in bed and I was like, had my rucksack on. I was like, should I go? And there was this like moment where she was like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, right. I'm not sure what I want to do. And she was like, look, if you go, you're probably going to do it. Huh. Like, and it was just this sort of like real kind of like fork in the road kind of yes. moment. And I was like, ah, oh, I think I want to do the Scots bass lessons thing. And she was like, well, don't go and do the Scots bass lessons thing. So I took my rucksack off, not knowing what the heck was in front of me, with like, you know, wow. probably like 2,000 or 3,000 subscribers on YouTube. I was teaching by Skype. I was earning, I kid you not, something like we joke, maybe, I don't know, like maybe less than $500 a year from the website at the time.
Right.
And so I started doing the Scots bass lessons thing and started working on it. And at one point, after about a year of, because I didn't know anything, I'd had to figure out how to build a website. I'd had to figure out yes. how to upload videos to YouTube. And I know that sounds like people are like, dude, that's easy. Well, it is now. But like back then when there was like, you couldn't do it. Do you know I mean? Like, I don't think I had a mobile phone. Do you know I mean? Like there was no smartphones. Right. It was like really, do you know I mean? Like we're talking a long time ago. And I've been doing it about a year. And I can remember Lisa saying, like, bless her, she was like, and she could see I was really trying. This was the conversation where are you really sure you're doing the right thing? It was like about a year after the yes. classical guitar school, you know, that fork in the road. And she was like, how long are you going to do this for? I was like, honestly, Lisa, I was like, I think I'm onto something. She was like, you've been doing it a year and you've made about $500. Mm. And I was like, I think I'm onto something. Honestly, I think I should keep on doing it. And it was like this real, I can remember that moment, man. I even remember in the house where I was standing and wow. and obviously carried on doing it and it went fine. So it was wild, man. It was a ride. It's good.
Do you feel like if you wouldn't have gone through what you went through with focal dystonia, if you wouldn't have met with that doc who said, pick what else can you do? And it was crushing. Do you think that SBL would have ever even crossed your mind?
No, I just wouldn't. No. I've said it before, but I'll say it again, man. I am so glad that I got focal dystonia. I'm so glad. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was the best. Like the sing from a career point of view, it was the, and actually I would argue from a personal point of view as well, you know, like meeting Lisa, having the kids, amazing. But family aside, getting focal dystonia is the single best thing that ever happened to me, ever. It's wild. Who knew it?
Break that down just a little bit. I mean, why do you say that? Because you had this idea of what was going to happen in your life and then you had to pivot and your life got better than you even imagined?
I was going down a comfortable route where I was like getting gigs and everything was great, and you know, and truth be told, I wasn't actually happy with where I was professionally at the time, but there was no real pathway for anything else. And it was just the obvious pathway. And I didn't know any, right. like, I just didn't know what was possible. And I came from a very, I guess, like, I was just like looking through the, like, you know, we were like said it like way back when, didn't we? We were talking about, I think that we're all walking around in these sort of like wormholes, like in Donnie Darko.
Yes, Darko. Yes.
Yeah, and we think that we are like living our lives to the fullest and we're really trying hard and we're kind of sort of like and all of that. But it's actually, you're just walking along in this like tiny little wormhole and what you're actually capable of is way more. And what focal dystonia did to me is strong arm me out of that mindset I was in and that pathway and put me on this completely different pathway where I've been able to grow so much and meet so many great people and kind of like expand my mind to what's possible. And Yeah, it was just, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me.
Well, and ever. You know, and as I hear birds chirping in the background.
Oh, yeah,
is
dude.
Is that I've on your end? It's just so lovely.
Yeah, man, I've got the door open and like the birds and the sun's out.
It's so lovely. It's just like it's this nice like ending to the podcast. I just want to say it's such an inspirational story because I've said this to you before, but I want to say it again. I just want to give you credit and agency and just explain that from my perspective, the fact that you built something amazing and that you have chosen the narrative for yourself that you would choose focal dystonia again, or that it was the best thing that's ever happened to you, that is testament to your character. It's testament to your mental health, and it's testament to your like fortitude in terms of going after something that you really want, because you could use that as the reason why your life didn't turn out. You could choose to be telling a different story. You could have chosen a different path, and you would have been right. That's the scary, crazy thing is you could have said, oh, I can't do this anymore. So I'm, you know, working this shit job now. And because I got focal dystonia, and no one would say, oh, hang on, man. You know, I think that's just about how you're looking at it. Everybody would say, oh, yeah, for sure. What a tragedy. Yeah. How sad that happened to Scott, you know, but he can't play anymore. But you chose to figure it out and turn that hardship. I mean, I don't want to sound too cheesy and too like, oh, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, but you decided in your mind that this was going to be a turning point. And I mean, obviously, I love how you explain this. It wasn't you got the diagnosis and then the next day this is going to be wonderful. I'm going to do this other thing. You talk about the progression of going and seeing all the different docs, right? And how painful and traumatic some of that experience was. And then when you had that fork in the road, you go be a luthier, the safe path, or you try this thing that's more... it's less predictable. There's way more unknown. You chose that, dude. Like, you decided to face into the void. And that's incredibly inspirational to me.
Dude, the void's
awesome.
And to
anybody else who's listening to this, dude, the void. But it's also terrifying. Yeah, you know, it's terrifying for so many people. But you've had this experience where you stared into the void and said, I'm going to give it a try. And I can't commend you enough. I mean, it's wildly inspirational to me. And I think for so many of our listeners too, I think this is really a story of triumph. And, you know, if anybody listening looks into their life and what are you using as an excuse? Now, it may be valid. That's fine. You may have a real thing that is holding you back, but are you using it as an excuse for safety, for comfort, for not taking the next step? I think this is a really inspirational story of how you are in control of your own narrative. You're in control of what you tell yourself. And then that narrative that you paint has a huge impact on the rest of your life. And I'm endlessly inspired by this story, Scott, and I really appreciate you sharing it with us.
It's amazing. That was a lot of cool stuff you just said. So massive thank you for all that. Really. But I also wanted to share this thing that kind of somebody mentioned. Oh, no, they shared with me. It was a point they were making. It was a friend of mine called Ajit Nawalkar, who is just an absolute beast. He is, he was like one of the minds behind a really, really successful large business. And I was having a conversation with him. It was unrelated to focal dystonia. And we were talking and he said, doing what you've done with SBL, he said, the best thing about it, he said that you've kind of uncovered the thing that not many people, the grasp. And he said, and the thing is that it's all just made up. He said, it's just all made up. He said, like SBL, he said, like, it looks like a big thing. He said, but you know that it's just, it was just, you just made it up out of thin air, really. You don't mean like you just sort you of like created it. Yeah. It wasn't yes. there. And you're absolutely right. So when I look forward to doing other things, I always remind myself what he said. All of this stuff is just made up. It doesn't need to exist. And it's kind of wild when you think about all of the other things.
That is wild.
It's kind of wild, isn't it? He was just like, it's all just made up. All of these things around us are just ideas that people had and they just made up. And I was like, whoa.
Right.
And it kind of just thinking about it in a really simplistic way like that makes me want to make stuff up. I'm just like, what can I make? What can I make? Because, because people need to make cool stuff in the world, right? And when you realize that it can be you and the team around you and you can all go on this journey together and just make this sort of like thing, like, man, like this. Oh, I think it's wild. I think it's wild, dude.
It's so crazy because I think so many people think that, oh, well, it needs to exist. I'm going to do a version or, oh, someone else needs to say it. And maybe, but that, wow, if you have an idea, that idea can be a thing that exists it can just be in your brain. What do you wish existed? It can exist. If you could, right?
Even like,
if
think you, about like bands. Pour into it. Just like bands, like the Beatles. They just made it up. They just made it up. I mean, like Muse.
They made it up.
Pearl Jam, Nirvana. Yeah. Like these, they just made it up. It didn't exist. It's available to everybody. We can just make stuff up. And it's just the decisions. Once you've got the idea, it comes down to the decisions you make after that fact and the journey towards it. Oh, man. I could talk about this stuff all day. But, dude, I'm going to have to skip because Gary's going to be like, Divine, where are you? I am sorry. Man.
It's wonderful. This was really great, and I think will be inspirational and helpful to so many people. So, man, thanks for the vulnerability and for just the time in talking about this. It's going to be massively helpful. I appreciate it.
Oh, dude, thanks for asking. Guys, thanks for listening, and we will see you on the next one. Take it easy. Bye.
Cheers, everybody.